This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2016. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The U.S. presidential campaign dominated the news throughout 2016 in the United States and in many countries around the world. Most pollsters and pundits predicted Democrat Hillary Clinton would prevail over Republican Donald Trump, even if by a small margin. However, Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University, was one of the few analysts who correctly foresaw Donald Trump's victory. How did he do it?
I was able to predict correctly a Trump victory, and I even doubled down on it in two interviews with the Washington Post, because I don't look at polls, I don't listen to the pundits, and I don't follow the day-to-day events of the campaign. Rather, my predictions are based on an historically established system. I developed it in 1981 in collaboration with the world-renowned mathematician Volodya Kylas-Borok. We looked at every American presidential election from 1860 to 1980, guided by the thesis that presidential elections are primarily judgments on the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. And we derived 13 key factors, the 13 keys to the White House, which gauge the prospects for the party holding the White House. And if six or more of those keys go against the White House party, they're predicted losers. And I was able to discern from this system the many vulnerabilities that the incumbent Democrats had. They took a big pasting in the midterm elections of 2014. They did not have their sitting president running. Open seats are tough. There was a third party bedeviling them through most of the campaign. They had a contentious nomination struggle because Republicans decided they would obstruct everything Barack Obama tried to do. In the second term, there was no major domestic policy accomplishment, and they didn't have a big foreign policy accomplishment. And Hillary Clinton was certainly a perfectly good candidate. This election loss cannot be pinned on her. She beat Donald Trump handily in all three debates, but she wasn't the once-in-a-generation inspirational candidate.
According to some analysts, the election results reflected a desire for change after 8 years of Democrat Barack Obama. In addition, despite the many qualifications of the party's nominee, Hillary Clinton, she suffered from perceptions of mistrust. So we asked John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center, who appeared on Encounter the day after the election, what factors contributed to Donald Trump's upset.
Well, I think a lot of us missed this. I mean, I think the story all along, leaving aside many of the personality things that a lot of us talked about, is Donald Trump shooting for a slightly different coalition in the Republican Party through the primaries, where he really emphasized immigration as a central issue to distinguish himself from his rivals? And then going forward, skepticism of trade into that and making a play for white working class voters. I think we all thought that he would get more of that vote, but perhaps lose some of his coalition, lose upscale suburban Republicans, women. Therefore, you know, he might not have enough to really do better than Mitt Romney or other Republicans in the past. Well, he surprised us. He's not going to win the popular vote. He may be a point or point and a half short of Hillary Clinton in votes, percentage-wise, but he did win the Electoral College by winning in states that we did not think he had a chance. States all across the Midwest, especially Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, states that have not gone for Republicans in quite a while that have a strong white working class background. And the shifts in these states were tremendous. Now, in other parts of the country, the tide went the other way. You saw California going, you know, much more strongly for Democrats, and in states like Texas, closer than you think. So the margin improved for Republicans only a few points. But the areas where Donald Trump improved by taking this message really brought him into places that we did not expect would happen and got a majority in the Electoral College in a way that many people thought was not possible.
One of the biggest challenges facing a new president is how to deal with Russia's resurgence on the world stage. On the one hand, the United States needs Russia's help in dealing with global challenges such as Iran and North Korea. On the other hand, U.S. intelligence officials blamed Russia for hacking into U.S. computer systems and leaking emails, thereby interfering, if not actually attempting to influence, the outcome of the U.S. election. Moscow deliberately undermines American and EU foreign policy on many fronts. In 2015, Russian President Vladimir Putin had the audacity to invade and annex Crimea, which was an integral part of Ukraine. upending the post-World War II order. And despite the so-called bromance between Vladimir Putin and President-elect Donald Trump, Russia may still prove to be a challenge to U.S. interests in the post-Obama era. William Pomerantz, deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Jeffrey Mankoff, senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, characterized U.S.-Russian relations this way. First, Will Pomerantz.
Well, I think they're very much at a low ebb, to put it mildly. Clearly, there's lots of areas of tension in Syria, in Ukraine, over Crimea. We still have a very severe sanctions regime against Russia as a result of what happened in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. And there's also been all the other sources of tension, including doping and hacking and all the rest.
Well, let me turn now to Jeffrey Mankoff for your take on U.S.-Russian relations to date.
Yeah, obviously they're pretty bad, but I think that there's a difference between the disputes that we're having with the Russians now and the whole history of disputes that we've had with them going back since the end of the Cold War. Because up until, let's say, 2011, 2012, there were plenty of things that we disagreed with the Russians about. We had spy scandals. We had tensions over Georgia. We had tensions over NATO expansion. We had a whole list of things where we found ourselves on opposite sides. But there was never an operating assumption here that the Russians saw themselves as a strategic rival, that they saw their interests as being advanced by trying to prevent us from doing the things that we sought to do, or that they were trying to overturn the basic pillars of the post-Cold War international security order. And I think now there's been a reassessment of the role that Russia is playing, largely for, I think, domestic political reasons within Russia itself. Moscow now is not only disagreeing about a whole set of concrete issues like the ones that Will listed, but also is portraying itself on a global level as being a rival to the United States, that in most cases its interests are best served by blocking or trying to undermine U.S. interests in a very kind of Cold War dynamic, and at the same time that Russia is trying to make fundamental changes to the rules of the game that emerged, at least in Europe, at the end of the Cold War. And so this is a much deeper period of tension between the U.S. and Russia than any that's existed since 1991.
Another unresolved issue that the incoming administration will inherit from President Barack Obama is the refugee crisis. According to the High Commissioner for Refugees, there are almost 65 million displaced people. This means that one out of every 113 people on Earth is a refugee. We revisited the global refugee crisis in October with the Vice President of Catholic Relief Services, Bill O'Keefe, and Dimitrios Papadimitriou, President Emeritus of the Migration Policy Institute. Bill O'Keefe reminds us of the parallels between the refugee crisis in the 1940s, which prompted the creation of CRS, and the crisis we face today.
I think your introduction mentioned our founding in 1943, and in some ways for us, this is a return to our roots. In 1943, we were responding to this massive refugee crisis at the end of the Second World War, and that's the same kind of scale that we're responding to now. In all the countries around Syria, so Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and then the European countries that have hosted refugees like Greece, Serbia, Macedonia, we have helped over 1.2 million people in the last 5 years since the beginning of the Syria crisis. And we're providing basic needs like food, shelter, you know, kind of basic kitchen supplies that people need when they are on the move, hygiene kits. But a lot of what we're doing is in these refugee hosting countries that have been very generous. I'm talking about Lebanon and Turkey and Jordan, each taken more than 1 million refugees. We've helped families to try to reestablish a normal life. And that's a big challenge, and one that's a challenge for the whole refugee system. But we're very proud of the progress that we've made, again, in the midst of this really overwhelming crisis.
Turning to you, Dimitrios Papadimitriou, with the Migration Policy Institute, talk about your characterization of the crisis today and what your organization is doing.
Well, the crisis is, as you already said, the largest, on par with what we saw at the end of the Second World War. I think what has motivated people to act now, rather than a year or two or three ago, is the fact that that crisis has actually reached European shores. Bill's organization, of course, works over there. And as a result, you know, they spend a lot of their effort and money and goodwill trying to protect people and care for them and help them maintain themselves over there. The reason that we have had all this attention, I'm convinced, is because the European nations realized that they were indeed, by proximity, by geography, part of where these things were happening. And this is what led to UN meetings that you referred to earlier. My concern and my organization's concern is that if the sense of a crisis begins to wane, then some of the things that these leaders got together in September to do may never materialize.
We asked Bill O'Keefe what structural reforms he thinks are required to mitigate the refugee crisis.
Obviously, the political system that has failed so dismally, which is why these crises continue to fester, that has been inadequately addressed. The second thing is that the system still is organized around a short-term humanitarian vision. It's as if we think that people are fleeing and they're going to be where they flee to for a couple of months. It turns out that your average refugee is a refugee for 19 years on average. That's a generation. And so the system needs to adjust to that reality and provide education and livelihoods and the opportunity for people to live a more normal life where they find themselves. And then finally, the United Nations plays a critical role in terms of coordinating humanitarian assistance. But there's a need to streamline that assistance so that the UN is no longer a donor, a coordinator, and an implementer. So more transparency and more accountability for how money flows through the system is needed to make the system as effective and efficient as possible.
Turning to you, Dimitris Papadimitriou, to talk about what you think needs to be done at the systemic level to address this major challenge. Do you agree with Bill O'Keefe that the UN summit did not necessarily address these systemic reforms and that they need to be addressed?
I certainly agree and subscribe to all three points that Bill made. The only area in which I am not in disagreement, but I don't know if the degree of skepticism focuses on the same thing, is the area in which that somehow the UN can, through some accident, be the place where many of those things are going to be fixed. I don't have an alternative. My alternative is an old-fashioned one in the sense that the states that actually take the lead are the ones that fear that they will be most impacted or affected by a crisis, and we should help the states actually lead. I do not believe that a universal organization like the UN can ever reach agreement on anything but the least common denominator. And this is what we saw in the General Assembly in the September events.
Turkey, a country which has been key in mitigating the migrant crisis, underwent a political upheaval in July, namely a failed coup attempt against the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. More than 300 people were killed and over 1,000 injured. Thousands were detained or arrested in the aftermath. Relations between Turkey and the United States have been strained over Ankara's extradition request for Imam Fethullah Gulen, who resides in the state of Pennsylvania and whom President Erdogan blames for instigating the coup. We asked Ambrin Zaman, public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Nick Danforth, senior policy analyst at the Bipartisan Policy Center, for their reactions to the news of the failed coup d'etat. First, Ambrin Zaman.
I was totally taken by surprise, knocked off my chair. In fact, when word came of unusual activity on the Bosphorus Bridge, I was in Istanbul at the time, and I just crossed that bridge like half an hour prior to these reports. I thought that there must be a sort of high ISIS threat alert going on, something along those lines. And that's why these extraordinary measures were being taken, you know, to defend the bridge, Atatürk's mausoleum, etc. So, yes, highly unexpected. And how is it different from previous coup attempts? Well, the last hard coup attempt, or rather successful coup, was in 1980, when the military directly intervened and seized power. But since then, military intervention has taken the form of sort of strong admonitions to the governments that they didn't like, as in 1997, when they basically forced Turkey's first Islamist government out of power. The difference this time also is that this coup was prevented, and prevented by the people. The people took to the streets, and this is the first time in the history of modern Turkey that that's happened.
Turning to you, Nick Danforth, for your reaction to the coup, I know I myself watched it unfold on television through Twitter, and by the end of the evening, you know, it had ended. What are your takeaways from this and how it differs from previous attempts?
I think before this, a number of analysts, both in Turkey and abroad, had concluded quite confidently that there was no possibility of there being a coup in Turkey. And in a way, they were proven right to the extent there was not a successful coup in Turkey. I guess what people had implicitly assumed is that the people in the military who might stage a coup would have been wise enough to realize that absent popular support, absent, it appears, even enough support within the military hierarchy, it would be foolhardy to stage a coup. And through some combination of foolhardiness and perhaps desperation, they went ahead with it anyways. The nation, Turkish democracy, paid the price. But as Umberan pointed out, it could have been far worse had people not come out on the street and actually, in many cases, quite courageously stood up to soldiers' tanks firing on them and, you know, prevented a takeover.
We've asked how this traumatic event and the subsequent extradition request for Fethullah Gulen affect relations between Ankara and Washington.
Part of what's made this such an issue in U.S.-Turkish relations, and, you know, it does seem like we're moving towards a slow-motion train wreck over this issue, is that Turkey has been very insistent that the United States extradite Fethullah Gulen. Obviously, if it turns out he was implicated in leading this coup, that would be a very reasonable request. The problem is everyone in Turkey is completely convinced, not just members of his movement that were involved, but that he personally ordered and orchestrated it. No one in the United States is necessarily denying that. There's, I think, people, you know, everyone that I've talked to in D.C. seems entirely open to this possibility. But people, A, they want convincing evidence, and more particularly, if there's going to be an extradition, the United States legal system requires that there be enough evidence for a judge in Pennsylvania to decide that there's probable cause to let the extradition go forward. And what's been creating so much frustration is that the Turkish government seems to view this desire for evidence as an affront, basically suggesting that if the United States fails as linking Fethullah Gulen to the coup.
Meanwhile, Turkey's regional ambitions have increased as President Erdogan consolidated power after the failed coup attempt. For example, a dispute arose between Ankara and Baghdad over Turkey's insistence on participating in the retaking of Mosul from the so-called Islamic State. Turkey's proposal prompted alarm in the West over yet another complication in a highly complex military campaign involving an unruly alliance of many rival forces to oust IS militants from Iraq. Brazil also dominated the headlines in 2016, whether as host of the Summer Olympics or because of political and economic turmoil, which eventually led to the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. Adding to its misfortunes was the outbreak of the Zika virus. Here is Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and the Council of the Americas, who appeared on Encounter in April.
Well, it's really unfortunate. It's almost a perfect storm. There's so many things happening at once, and none of them seem to be good. The Olympics were meant to be Brazil's coming out party. When they were first given to Brazil, a decision that I personally strongly supported and continue to support, Brazil was riding high. It was a country that could do no wrong. The then president, Lula da Silva, was an international celebrity. Brazil's economy was reporting double-digit gains. It was a country that was standing up to the United States in some ways and standing up to the established order and really establishing its own voice on the global stage. And all of this was a long time in coming. If you fast forward now to today, you have a completely different picture of Brazil. And my fear is that as the international community, perhaps for the first time in many cases, looks at Brazil, instead of seeing a country that's having a coming out party and a real celebration of where it's come, they will see a country that's really on its knees in some way, and a country that is having difficulties finding a path forward politically and economically. That, to me, is a real tragedy because Brazil is a country that deserves a very strong place on the global stage, and it is a country that will find its way. But the snapshot that many people will see in the run-up to the Olympics and the Olympics itself will be one that's considerably less optimistic.
Domestically, throughout 2016, a national debate over racial bias in law enforcement intensified, given a string of attacks on African Americans and other minorities by white police officers. In reaction, a black Army veteran who was angry over police killings of two black men in Louisiana and Minnesota shot and killed five white police officers in Dallas, Texas in July. Sam Fullwood, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who appeared on Encounter in mid-July, described the unfortunate situation this way.
And I think the gross overreaction of police officers, particularly in communities of color across the country, is a reflection of our unfinished business with race in this society. I think that the police have a difficult job, and for the most part, they do it admirably. But circumstances arise where police, particularly those who may not be as well trained as they need to be, are confronted with a tense situation, and some baser instincts fall out. That is, they are immediately struck with some kind of primal fear of black people that lead them to overreact, that overrides their training or their limited amount of training.
Our second panelist, Anthony Cook, professor at Georgetown University Law School, had this to add.
You know, we live in a society in which in 2015, there were 1,000 basically killings by police officers of civilian population. And of that 1,000, black people were, you know, 3 to 4 times more likely to be shot and killed. Black people or black men only constitute 6% of the nation's population, but yet they are 40% of those who were killed without arms. They weren't armed. And so while you do have a situation where if you take that 1,000, it's true that a majority of those who were shot and killed were white, black people are being disproportionately killed. So it's really a tale of two cities. We do have some problems with regard to a certain segment of law enforcement that's long overdue with regard to analysis and correctives. It impacts white people, Asian people, Hispanic people, as it impacts black people. But also, black people are disproportionately, by a significant stretch, impacted by this criminal justice system when it comes to the use of lethal force, when it comes to being targeted and profiled and stopped and frisked and thrown up against a wall or handcuffed and mistreated. They are disproportionately impacted by all these practices. And we've got to be able to tell both of those stories and to not shy away from either one of them.
Hence, when President Obama attended the funeral ceremony to honor the slain Dallas police officers, he said,
"And so when African Americans from all walks of life, from different communities across the country, voice a growing despair over what they perceive to be unequal treatment, when study after study shows that whites and people of color experience the criminal justice system differently, so that if you're black, you're more likely to be pulled over or searched or arrested, more likely to get longer sentences, more likely to get the death penalty for the same crime, when mothers and fathers raise their kids right and have the talk about how to respond if stopped by a police officer, yes, sir, no, sir, but still fear that something terrible may happen when their child walks out the door. When all this takes place more than 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, we cannot simply turn away and dismiss those in peaceful protest as troublemakers or paranoid."
Racial tensions will likely persist and may even intensify given President-elect Trump's emphasis on law and order, and will constitute one of many domestic issues that a new U.S. president will face in the months and years ahead. Before we go, this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And you could always send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks to Anna Zalewski and Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.